Welcome to the Over My Dead Body podcast, season 2, episode 5. I'm your host, Alex Liddington Cox. This episode is huge. It's about breastfeeding and the role of dads. Young dads are told our job is to support the mum, whatever that means. My sense from young parents today is that the decision to breastfeed and to what extent is mostly taken by the mum. The dad is used as a sounding board and included to the extent that they are needed to support and facilitate the breastfeeding. And that's the way it should be, because we can't do it for you. Breastfeeding is a mother's issue. And when we consider the long and sorry history of silly old blowhard fuckwit men lecturing women about their bodies, it's fair to say I wade into today's episode with some hesitation. But let me be clear, I and none of my guests today are here to tell any mum what to do with their body. Instead, what you'll hear today is, in my belief, there is a point in which breastfeeding becomes a dad's issue, and that is when the mum's health and well-being is at serious and unnecessary risk. It's hard to object to breastfeeding, silly in fact. Breastfeeding is more convenient than formula, more environmentally sustainable than formula, and way cheaper than formula. As a matter of fact, it's free. It is inflation-proof. But the biggest draw card to breastfeeding is the health benefits. According to the Australian Breastfeeding Association and the World Health Organization, breastfeeding is credited with preventing everything from SIDS, low IQ, and obesity in babies to reducing cancer in mums. And young mums, in my experience, set about breastfeeding with a quiet but firm determination. It is their first tangible act to give their kid, our kids, the best start in life. And at every point on their journey, from trying to conceive to well after the birth, the medical industry is there to reinforce the message that breast is best. And any dads who have attended those prenatal appointments or a maternal healthcare appointment knows what I'm talking about. And it's working well in Australia. Results from the 2010 Australian National Infant Feeding Survey, the latest research that we have, shows that 96% of mums start breastfeeding and 6 out of 10 babies are still being breastfed at 6 months. In the US, it's less than 1 in 3. But it's hard. Perinatal Anxiety and Depression Australia, also known as PANDA, told the Over My Dad Body podcast 17% of their callers are mums experiencing difficulty breastfeeding, almost 1 in 5. Beyond Blue reports 1 in 6 mums experience postnatal depression. And according to one study published in midwifery journal Women and Birth, quote, most women with postnatal depression desired to breastfeed but experienced breastfeeding difficulties that could impact on their mental health, unquote. Young mums that struggle to breastfeed feel like they're kind of letting the side down. As a young dad, what do you say in a situation like that? It doesn't matter how we spin it, and I'm a PR, I know what I'm talking about here. The effort our partner has gone through to make breastfeeding a success means nothing but time will overcome the sense of guilt, disappointment, and failure when it doesn't work. It is only once we've reached this point that I would argue that breastfeeding becomes a father's issue. Because when fathers in this situation discover that the science behind the health benefits of breastfeeding, which is the main vehicle for all this guilt that their partner is feeling, is not nearly as convincing as the breastfeeding mafia would have you believe, we have to ask ourselves, was all that pressure really necessary? Today you'll hear a first-hand account from a friend of the podcast and father of two, Matt Imlach, on the impact of breastfeeding challenges on his family. Then you'll hear a conversation between leading epidemiologist and father-to-be, Gideon Marovich-Katz, with the University of Wollongong, whose writing you might have seen in Guardian Australia and elsewhere, and another friend of the podcast, award-winning science writer from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald and published author, Liam Mannix. I must stress again, we're not here to argue against breastfeeding. No way. What we are here to do is provide proper context around the science of breastfeeding so that if that day comes when a mum has reached her breaking point, dads can have the confidence to step in and say, "Babe, it's okay." I also want to take the opportunity to thank Perinatal Anxiety and Depression Australia and Beyond Blue for their assistance with this podcast. The Australian Breastfeeding Association declined to comment. And now I give you the Oaks.
This moment, and it's good to see you, good to hear you talk.
But there was one day when we were, and this is pretty gross, so I don't know if people, you know, if you've got a weak stomach, maybe just put your fingers in your ears for 30 seconds. I pulled the packing out, and the milk that was backed up behind, and a whole lot of blood and everything sprayed out of the wound. I wore most of it. She started bawling. I gave her a cuddle, and then we were just like, this is it. This is the end. We're not pushing this anymore.
This is Matt, a great friend of the podcast. This is a story about how the pressure to breastfeed can push a family to the brink.
So we had breast care nurses that were saying, push through, you've got to push through, because otherwise you'll end up with mastitis if it gets blocked up, and then you get infections and all this sort of stuff. But because she ended up with a 400 mil abscess in her boob. We're talking about a Coke can's, you know, worth of abscess in her right boob. So I can't imagine the pain.
After 5 weeks of second, third, and fourth opinions, Ali's abscess was finally identified, and she was rushed to emergency amid concerns she might be about to go into septic shock.
She did push through without any luck.
When you made the decision to stop, what was the breaking point?
So, oh God. So we'd probably, this is probably 2 weeks after the surgery. Well, actually immediately after the surgery, they left the wound open to her boob. And so I had to go to training to learn how to pack the wound. So she had about a 5 centimeter or 50 millimeter deep slice to allow that, that abscess to heal from the inside out. So every day, I think it was it once a day or twice a day, I'd have to go in there, pull all the packing out, and then repack, and then bandage and sterilize and all this sort of stuff. So every day, it was nice to be able to help in that way. But there was one day when we were, and this is pretty gross, so I don't know if people, you know, if you've got a weak stomach, maybe just put your fingers in your ears for 30 seconds. But we're having a shower together, so I was packing. I was actually emptying the packing from the day before. I pulled the packing out, and the milk that was backed up behind, and a whole lot of blood and everything sprayed out of the wound. I wore most of it. She started bawling. I gave her a cuddle, and then we were just like, this is it. This is the end. We're not pushing this anymore.
So that's how Matt's family reached their breaking point with breastfeeding. It's worth noting a few things. One, Ali was diagnosed with postpartum depression after this event. 2. Ali was treated correctly according to the Australian Breastfeeding Association's guidelines. 3. Ali's second-born Eleanor was a really strong feeder, but Ali experienced the same pain symptoms and ended up in hospital with a fever of 41 degrees. 4. Despite this medical history, doctors insisted Ali continue breastfeeding. Getting the correct care took persistence. After multiple requests, Ali was finally permitted to switch Eleanor to formula. While the relief was palpable, the experience had a lasting impact.
It's years, I reckon. I think a lot of the feeding is what absolutely caused the postnatal depression. I think once that was sort of activated in her body, it was a really difficult thing to get rid of.
When she went on the drugs, she got super happy, but you were quietly second guessing whether or not she's genuinely happy or whether or not she's actually a bit high. And what happens when she goes off the drugs? Does she go back down or does she find a new baseline?
I think also too with any sort, like I've never had medication for depression or anything like that, but I imagine it's quite hard to find the right dose, the right type of drug, all that sort of stuff. And she did immediately perk up to the point where I was like, oh, this is just a veneer. This isn't actually my wife that I'm seeing every day. But then I'm like, at least she's happy. So I think trying to find, you know, an equilibrium where she was happy and functioning, but it wasn't fake. I guess in the end she nailed it, because to me, you know, after a while, you're just like, oh, this is the old Ali back sort of thing. But
yeah,
it was such a roller coaster that period.
So that was father of two, Matt Imlach, talking about the impact of the breastfeeding versus formula debate on his family. We'll go now to our panel discussion. We're joined today by Gideon Myrowitz-Katz, an epidemiologist with the University of Wollongong. You might have seen his writing in Guardian Australia and elsewhere. Welcome to the program, Gideon. Really happy to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Awesome. And we're welcoming back Liam Mannix, science writer for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Liam, also happy to have you here as well.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Gideon, we're going to start with you. First of all, I understand you and your partner are about to have a baby, or you're having a baby later this year. How is it all going?
It's been a fun time. I think as most new parents, or potential new parents, soon to be new parents are, we're having a great panic about all the various things we have to do before the baby comes. I've kind of internalized that by frantically researching every topic that comes on our way. I had a great time recently being told that epidurals might be problematic. And so then I spent the next week reading the Cochrane reviews into epidurals for labor analgesia, which was great fun.
Epidemiologists became like superstars of the moment during COVID-19, but I don't think people really understood what they actually do. Can you just give a summary for the audience about what your job actually entails?
I often describe myself as a doctor of spreadsheets. Most epidemiology is kind of collating population statistics on health, in my case, mostly chronic disease, and then looking into questions of kind of disease prevalence and severity, who's most impacted by various diseases, and then also doing research and evaluation into methods to improve that.
Turning now to your two-part piece on the science behind formula and breast milk, I have linked to both in the episode summary and our social media channels. We're talking specifically about the science of breast milk, part two, especially the claims that it carries a number of health benefits for baby and mother. Have you gotten a reaction to the piece?
Yeah, most of my pieces get some sort of reaction. And I think in general, the reaction was quite positive. There are always people who are mean to me on Twitter, but I've long since learned to ignore the Twitter haters.
So I get called a cuck on Twitter. What were you getting called?
I have been called almost every name that I can imagine is in the English lexicon. I have once been called a traitor. Someone, because one of my thesis supervisors worked with someone who is originally from a Chinese university. Apparently I am a traitor to the Australian something, which was bizarre. It was great fun, but very odd.
Oh, wow.
From this specific blog, I can't remember exactly, but I'm sure there were names thrown at me.
Your piece, I know this is pretty like sort of almost a granular place to start, but your piece focuses on terms such as related and causes. Can you explain the significance of these terms from a scientific perspective when it comes to making claims about how breastfeeding does this or that?
Yeah, so I think basically the entire story of breastfeeding and our understanding of how it impacts human health comes back to the difference between a causal association and an association which is not causal. And so when I'm talking about that, what I mean is that we can observe differences between groups of people, of populations. So in this case, children who are breastfed and children who are not breastfed. And we can say that there are differences between those two groups, but it is very hard to know why those differences occur. So as an example, one of the main claims that for breast milk, breastfeeding, is that it improves IQ. And that's something that's repeated quite a bit. And that's based on observational research, where we look at children who are breastfed and we compare them to children who are not. And we find that children who are breastfed, when they're about 10 or 11, tend to have slightly higher IQ than children who are not breastfed. But the challenge is that there are many things that impact both IQ and the ability to breastfeed. So, for example, in high-income countries, and so I should also clarify that a lot of this is only based on high-income countries, and there's a very different kind of scientific aspect when you look at low-income countries. But in high-income countries, women who breastfeed, who breastfeed exclusively and who breastfeed for longer, tend to be wealthier, and they tend to have other characteristics that we associate with high IQ. And so to an extent, you can control for that in very large epidemiological studies, but there's often the possibility that there are other things causing both the ability to breastfeed and the high IQ, which means that we don't know whether high IQ is related to breastfeeding or if it's caused by the breastfeeding itself.
Organizations from, you know, like the World Health Organization to the Australian Breastfeeding Association claim to this day that breast milk helps reduce infectious disease, improve intelligence, like you said, and reduce obesity in babies and reduce cancer rates in the mother. Is that true?
So this is where I think we go from we go through a range of claims, some of which are very supported by evidence and some of which get more complicated. So when it comes to most of these claims, a lot of the evidence, as I was describing just before, is observational. We look at two groups of people and we say one group this happens to and one group this happens to, and then we look at the outcome. That gives us some information, and that's what almost all of the claims, particularly for the mother's health, are based on. And also many of these claims, such as intelligence or obesity, are based on. What we really want when we're looking at causal connections in health is a randomized study where you allocate people to either receive the intervention or no intervention and see the difference, because that gets rid of a lot of these issues where we're looking at associations rather than a causal connection. But generally speaking, it's really hard to randomize people to receive either breastfeeding or no breastfeeding. I mean, it's impossible. There are so many issues with that trial design. But there is a study called the ProBit study that randomized women in Belarus to either be part of an enhanced breastfeeding program, which provided breastfeeding education and encouragement, or care as usual. And in that study, the rate of exclusive breastfeeding was dramatically higher in the women who were encouraged to breastfeed, about four times higher. And it was about 11% compared to, I think it was about 45% in the women who were told to breastfeed. And I'm not going to go into depth into the criticisms of the ProBit study and the relative strengths and weaknesses, but it gives us some idea about kind of these causal connections. So rather than just saying this is observational research that may or may not provide us evidence, direct evidence of one thing causing another, it gives us some ability to say, does breastfeeding assist with all of these different things that we think it might? And what they found in that study is very strong evidence that reduces infectious disease in infants. And while they only found a statistically significant benefit for gastrointestinal infections, they also found similar benefits that were not statistically significant, but still in the same direction for other infectious diseases like colds and flu.
Okay. And so the quality of this study, or the way in which it was conducted at least, raises some pretty basic questions about a lot of the other studies that don't use these sort of methods. Am I understanding that correctly?
It doesn't necessarily raise questions. It's just that, generally speaking, when we're talking about observational evidence, which is what essentially all breastfeeding promotion material is based on, it's very hard to know if the effects that we're seeing are directly caused by breastfeeding or if they might be attributable to the type of person who is able to breastfeed in our society.
Did in Probit, did they manage to show any other statistically significant effects of breastfeeding?
20 studies based on Probit, because what happened was they did this massive tens of thousands of people randomized study, which the initial results came out in 2002, and then they've done a series of follow-up studies in the decades since. And so off the top of my head, I can't remember the results of every single piece of research that's come out of this huge thing, but the main claims, they did find a statistically significant improvement in IQ at the age of 6, but not at the age of 11 in between the two groups of breastfed versus not breastfed, or rather breastfeeding promotion versus no breastfeeding promotion. They found no benefit on psychosocial measures, no benefit on obesity and related cardiometabolic indicators. So that's kind of blood sugar, blood pressure, that sort of thing. And they did find a very small difference. And there was one psychosocial measure that was different. I think it was related to attitude towards food. They found some differences in terms of attitude towards food at age 11.
Jeez, it's not much, is it? Considering how much stock and the huge claims that are made about breast milk.
Yeah, so I think that's really the key. I wouldn't say based on Probit that breastfeeding has no benefits, but when you consider that most of the stuff you will read online says that it helps, that it does all of these amazing things that you know we heard about just a minute ago, reduces the risk of obesity, improves intelligence, reduces the risk of cancer, improves psychosocial behavior. You know, there are studies that claim reductions in anxiety, depression, ADHD, all sorts of long-term health issues. And Probit, for all its flaws and limitations, didn't find any of those in nearly the sort of the magnitude that you might expect if all of these claims were accurate.
Let's bring it down to your household. Like, what's the discussion been like with your partner about what this research means for the pair of you and your baby? And assuming everything goes well, are you going to supplement with formula? How long are you going to be breastfeeding for? What's the ideal outcome for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, we've looked at the evidence quite extensively. My partner's also very interested in the question, of course. And our plan is to breastfeed and not to stress if it doesn't work out, basically. And I have to say, I think that's a very evidence-based position, personally. I think it's also a very Australian position. Exclusive breastfeeding, we have some of the higher rates of exclusive breastfeeding in the high-income countries. It's about 66% based on the last ABS survey, Australian Bureau of Statistics survey. So I think that's basically what most Australians try is to breastfeed, and then if it doesn't work out, go for formula.
Leon, turning to you now, you've got a daughter at home. Your partner has run the gauntlet from pregnancy, birth to breastfeeding. How has your family experienced the breast is best messaging throughout the whole process? And what impact do you think it has on new mothers?
I think it came to us really strongly from two places. First of all, at the hospital. So we stayed a couple of days after Caroline had her C-section, and the nurses there were very insistent on breastfeeding. Which is what they're trained to do. So, you know, from the moment that Evie was born, they tried to put her on the breast. And Caroline had just been operated on, and she's like, well, I'm trying to do this. She didn't have a lot of milk at first, so it was really tough. Evie was born very small, so her mouth was too small. And so we have these sessions because the baby, you know, the baby will cry when she's hungry. So the baby would be crying, and Caroline and a few nurses would be trying to get the breastfeeding to work, and it wasn't working. Before Cara gave birth, we had decided that we wanted to mix feed. So I had the formula And I was looking at Caroline in enormous distress and our baby in a fair bit of distress and saying, hey, guys, should we do some formula to make things easier? And the nurses were clearly very upset with me. Like, there was a real level of hostility. And I appreciate entirely where they come from. It's really hard in that early period because to get the milk to come in, is my understanding, you have to do the breastfeeding. And so you have to go through this shitty bit where the baby can't really get much out and everybody's upset to get it to work. So there's this enormous like difficulty curve for a lot of women. And here was me saying, oh, let's skip the difficult bits. Let's do the formula. So I got a lot of pressure from the nurses at hospital, which Carol and I found quite difficult. And then I also got a lot of pressure from my family. I think they were quite upset at the idea that I was happy to formula feed. Certainly there were instances we were staying at their house and the baby would wake up and our schedule was, oh, it's Liam's time to feed. So I would go get the formula and they'd go and wake Caroline up quite deliberately and say, you need to breastfeed this baby. And that was pretty upsetting, to be honest. I've spoken to them about that as well. So yeah, Caroline and I found breastfeeding reasonably difficult and upsetting. And I know it works wonderfully for some couples, and I think that's fantastic. But yeah, it was pretty tough for us.
With Hazel's birth, so Hazel's my first Gideon, she's almost four now. I can remember she was born very small. She was born at 2.5 kilos and her weight dipped below 2.5 kilos. And they don't let you leave the hospital until their weight is back up above 2.5 kilos. Like it's just one of these thresholds that you suddenly discover once you're in there. I did have the privilege of getting to sleep in the Royal Women's Hospital. Like I, you know, they didn't kick me out. So that was pretty
cool. Is that a privilege, Alex?
Well,
I slept in there. It was awful.
Well, I was sleeping on a chair. But
exactly,
my gender is not blazoned on the front of the hospital. So I felt pretty happy that I still got a seat. There were a lot of dads that didn't, but I can remember them, you know, they explained this process that her body weight is going to dip likely for these few days and you need to feed her as much as possible. You need to collect the colostrum. And so I'm like, you know, getting all this, you know, using these little needles and getting it out of Rachel's breast. And because she'd had an emergency cesarean, it took a while for her milk to come in. And doctors are normally very, very good at explaining this is the sequence of events that you are likely to go through. And at no point did they say, if Hazel's birth weight dips below this level, we will start introducing formula. And that just seemed to be the obvious way to reassure us, and it was never even brought up. It was as if it was the word of which you do not speak, which we found quite confusing. Liam, I imagine that this is the context with which you have experienced the term breast milk mafia.
To an extent, yeah. I mean, it hasn't been too bad for us beyond that, but certainly, you know, Gid alluded to this a bit before. It is a very polarized debate. I think it's up there with controlled crying in that the two sides, there isn't a lot of consensus in the middle about it. There's two sides and they both think that you're killing children. But can I ask a question of you about this, Gid? We've talked about the sort of lack of hard evidence or high quality evidence for a lot of these claims. Why is it, do you think, that the importance of breastfeeding has so penetrated the medical establishment? Like, if the evidence isn't super solid, what is it that's really driving this?
I think, to be honest, in part, it's a reaction to the industry.
Yes.
I think it's a problem because on the one hand, formula is literally a necessary medical product, right? Mm. Absolutely saves lives. Mm. There's no question. Because prior to the introduction of formula, some babies would starve to death. Mm. And that was bad. And now it is extraordinarily rare that babies starve to death, which is a good thing. But there is a massive industry that exists to make money off parents and does so by lying. And that is also... Yeah. essentially unquestionable, because I mean, that was the other piece that I wrote, was essentially on, there's an extensive history of the formula industry creating desire for their products by fermenting these lies or these extremely misleading statements. You know, like their formula is improves bone health because it contains calcium, but actually, if it didn't contain calcium, then it would be murdering children. So it's like trying to score points for not murdering babies is, you know, interesting place to be. And so I think that the medical establishment and a lot of people feel that the breastfeeding is the first and should be the only option unless there's some sort of serious life-threatening issue. And so a lot of it is pushback against these people who are making money off of misleading statements.
Right, okay.
We should we should probably talk here also about Nestlé's conduct in Africa, where with this marketing, they, and correct me if I'm wrong, they were essentially encouraging some of the poorest and most disadvantaged members of our global community to use formula rather than breast milk, which of course, you know, is economically harmful. And then because they were using it in places with unsafe water, they ended up creating a really unsafe product. And I think a number of babies were harmed.
Yeah. So there is a great deal of problematic history in terms of formula companies, not just Nestlé and the developing world and lower income places. So I think there's a very understandable, you know, feeling of discomfort from medical professionals with the formula industry and formula in general. And I do also think that there's a lot of honest goodwill in that people believe that the evidence supports breastfeeding almost to the exclusion of, you know, any other option. And a lot of people feel that you should try anything you can because breastfeeding is so much better. I just don't think that the evidence is quite strong enough to make some of the claims that people are convinced by.
And like when you're on the receiving end of, like, just to go back to the hospital, when these people have such authority over you when you're in a very, very vulnerable place and you kind of go with it, like the role that men are told we need to be for our partners is an advocate and a support for our partner. And the default position that I consistently find myself falling under, for, you know, retreating to, when Rachel's just losing her mind at a medical professional, it is, these are medical professionals. Their advice is backed up by hard science. You should trust them. And that works in almost all instances. But in this one, it just doesn't seem that convincing. And that line of trust this person and trust their advice doesn't hold sway.
But can I ask about this? Because I find this a really difficult issue to think about. I feel like there's some level of privilege that we three have in this conversation, in that we're all, you know, educated, wealthy, well, you know, wealthy on a global scale, people who are trying to think about evidence here. That's a pretty privileged position. Like, most people aren't going to be going through the sort of risk-benefit analysis that Gid was doing when he was trying to make sense of this. Like, if that's the case, can we really fault our medical decision makers for just going for, like, almost a default option rather than this one where, you know, you and I are trying to have to think it through and sort through the evidence? Like,
absolutely. And perhaps we can skip forward to a question that's a little bit further down the schedule. A number of fathers that I've spoken to have noticed signs in maternal healthcare centres displaying the number of ingredients in breast milk compared to the number of ingredients in formula. And it's really confronting, like, just to see that stark difference. And you can kind of extrapolate, like, well, how many, you know, Harvard business degrees am I going to rob my child of if I go with column B instead of column A? And then you find out a little bit more about the research. But I do wonder if those signs, I don't want to come across as condescending, but I wonder if those signs are not meant for us. And I'm interested to note that the maternal healthcare centre nearby has actually taken that sign down. So I was wondering if you guys have seen that sign and what your reaction was to it.
Look, I've never seen that specific sign, I don't think, but I've seen many, many things online like that. I find them very problematic, not very helpful in any way, because this comes from the idea of ultra processed foods versus processed foods. It's this way of defining foods into categories of various processing levels, and formula by definition is an ultra processed food because you take various products to create a food that babies can survive on that isn't human breast milk. And the thing I think about when I see that sort of rhetoric online is, how would a mother who has severe mastitis or who has had a mastectomy or is otherwise unable to breastfeed feel if they saw that poster? And how would a father who has some issue that gets in the way of breastfeeding feel about their child? And I think that generally speaking, it's unhelpful because the number of ingredients has very little to do with how healthy or unhealthy a specific food is. And formula for some babies is necessary for life. So demonizing it out of hand is not a useful way to communicate with people. I think the conversation should always be about cost benefit, not about making formula seem like this horrifying problem that needs to be fixed.
I'm just going to take you for a moment back to father of two, Matt, about the knock-on effects that the breast is best messaging had on his thinking.
But I do have to be honest, like switching Eleanor to formula earlier than Isla, I was because you told all this stuff, I was watching for like markers that, oh, is she a bit behind? Is she a bit this? Is she a bit that? In reality, I should just never have given it a second thought, but I was watching out, you know, even going to get your like parent-teacher interview sort of stuff. It's like, is she socially adjusted? And it's probably all horseshit, but it's, you know, you still worry because of that.
We'll be right back. We're talking again with epidemiologist Gideon Mirovich-Katz and science journalist Liam Mannix about the science of breast milk versus formula. Let's pick up the conversation again on the impact that breastfeeding has on relationship dynamics.
Yeah. Alex, we're on a dad podcast.
Yes.
So I think... can we speak about dads and breastfeeding for a moment?
100%, please. Okay. So
let's inject some patriarchy into this conversation. So one of the things that I have long pondered is the role of breastfeeding in the bonding between a father and their infant, and in setting up how a couple with a newborn infant is going to face the rest of their life. Because looking back on when we had a baby, it's a real break. Like, your life changes forever and it's never the same. Get ready for that, kid. But what I have wondered, I was sitting in a park speaking to another dad, and he said to me, oh, you know, my child's 18 months old and I've decided to go down to 4 days because I haven't really bonded with her. You know, it's he actually said to me, he's like, yeah, she's having a bad day because she's hanging out with me and she doesn't really know me very well. I was like, wow, 18 months and this is what's happening. And talking a bit more with him, he said, well, you know, we exclusively breastfed. And I always felt, this is what he said, that I was the secondary parent, which is something that I have heard from a number of fathers. Like, if you're exclusively breastfeeding, particularly if your partner doesn't want to express, which, fair enough, expressing is awful by the sounds of it, you can end up in this situation where the baby wakes up and the mother gets up and the dad gets up just because he feels like he wants to be involved, but he's not really essentially there. So I have been wondering if that perhaps means that it takes a bit longer for dads to bond with their newborns. Now, I tried to do a bit of a literature search on this. There are a number of very small sort of survey-based studies. If you look in them, you do see that a significant number of dads say, yes, I found that bonding meant that it took me a little while longer to bond with my newborn, that I felt like a secondary parent. Some of the ones that I found the most interesting were this suggestion from some men that they felt like they lacked a bit of self-efficacy, that they weren't really involved. And on parenting websites, you do see this idea a lot from women hey, my partner's not involved enough. I need him to, you know, get his shit together and help me here. So I felt like looking at all that, there is not enough. I didn't feel to really say anything conclusive, but I am very interested in your feelings, because I think that we talk about breastfeeding's health benefits to the baby. We talk about its benefits to the mother, but it seems like we're not really considering what exclusive breastfeeding or the decision to mix or to formula feed might have on that other important relationship in a newborn's life, which is with the father.
I've got two things to say to that. So actually three things. We've noticed that I've done less of the feeding with Beatrix than with Hazel. It's just kind of worked out that way. Perhaps there was
Beatrix
a great...
Beatrix is your second child.
Yeah, Beatrix is my second child, and perhaps a greater percentage of... Beatrix has had a greater percentage of breastfeeding in the first sort of 6 to 8 months. So it's meant that I've had less time with her. And we have noticed, it might be at the margins, but it feels like I have less of a connection with her than I had with Hazel. And I did noticeably more of the feeding with Hazel. Just to move on to the second story, the ashes were on. And I just sort of decided that I was going to do all of the overnight feeding. And the number of times where I'd wake up at like 2 o'clock in the morning and I'd feed her and I'd just, throw the ashes on my laptop. And then we would just be having a cuddle on the couch and I'd just be sitting there going, this feels just great. And
this
we're kicking
the
pom's ass.
Right? It's really nice. And women get to have this experience and men want a bit too. Come on.
And I would just, a feed would go from 10 minutes to like a whole session. I would just sit there for 90 minutes and Hazel would just be sleeping on my chest. And I'm just like, I could do this forever. And the other just kind of related to this, I was telling my dad about my experience of relationship dynamics in the aftermath of having a child. And because women have this quarantine period where they are the primary caregiver, which is a loaded term, but they get all the practice at the start and they get all this bonding. And the way that I worded it to my dad was that, women having breasts gives them such power over men in the immediate aftermath about having a child. And my dad, who's 76, doesn't skip a beat, he said, women have always had power over men because they have breasts. And I was just like, but I'm dead. I'm 76, but I'm still a man.
This is a good level of patriarchy for this podcast.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying this. No, no. I think that gets at an important point, though. Like, because you set up the relationship dynamic in such a way that one parent is very essential and the other is ancillary, I do wonder about the long-term effects of that on resumption of work for the woman, resumption of career, ending up, where do you end up with the balance at for who takes care of the baby? Like, my dad would class himself as a big feminist, but I discovered when we had Evie that he never changed my diaper. I thought he was very involved, but actually he wasn't, just because it kind of wasn't done. He wasn't part of it.
I'm really enjoying this particular part of the conversation. I do want to bring Gideon in.
Yeah, we need to ask Gid.
Yeah.
I'm better at the scientific questions and less good at the qualitative questions of fatherhood.
Well, this is a hot takes podcast.
From a scientific perspective, it is interesting. I haven't seen any strong evidence that exclusive breastfeeding versus non-exclusive breastfeeding, and it's kind of assumed because more breastfeeding is better. But I'm not sure. I'd be interested to see the impact of kind of sharing the load in terms of formula feeding and how that might impact relationships with the father.
Unfortunately, this seems to be the case for a lot of fatherhood research. Like, I don't know if you've done much hunting around, but I've sort of been talking to some scientists to try and get a sense of what we know about fatherhood. And there is very little that we know about the impact of fathers on the developing child, which I think is kind of a shame in some ways.
Liam, I've got a question for you. If you had been doing those feeds with Evie with formula and you didn't know that there were question marks about, the way that breast milk is kind of marketed and all of these purported benefits, would that have soured the experience for you at all?
Sorry, Alex, can you ask that again? I didn't quite understand the question.
So imagine this scenario. You're sitting there, you're feeding Evie with formula because Caro has had some difficulty with breastfeeding, or she has stopped expressing, and you are unaware that the claims about SIDS and IQ and obesity are inflated, inflated, what, like, would that change the experience for you?
Would I feel guilty?
Yeah.
Of course I'd feel guilty, Alex. This is what you're going to learn very soon, Gib. Parenting is all guilt, my friend.
See, and I 100%. Think that's my biggest issue in the breastfeeding versus formula debate, because I think that you can acknowledge that breastfeeding is probably beneficial, particularly in terms of reducing infectious diseases, which is a good thing. And you can also acknowledge that people shouldn't feel guilty for formula feeding their baby. And it also comes back to something that I think is very important, which is that epidemiology is meaningless to the individual. There is individual health advice, which is extremely different to population health advice. And when it comes to your child, there is a big difference between the population studies and your own experience. And
can you explain a bit more about why there is a difference between individual and population health advice?
Because individuals are not populations. Because we can say on average that if you breastfeed, if every child was breastfed, you would reduce this number of gastrointestinal infections. But that doesn't mean that if you feed your child formula, it will make their health worse. You can run large trials. You can even run large randomized trials where you compare populations to each other. But you cannot run a trial on yourself, because unfortunately we can't go back in time and do it the other way, right? So you don't know what would happen if you had made different choices. You can speculate. And we can say that on average, if you had made these choices, 100,000 Liams, you would find that on average those 100,000 Liams children would be slightly different. But your child may not be impacted at all negatively by using exclusively formula, right?
Interesting.
And this is why I think it's important to take the guilt out of the equation, because if you have an issue that prevents breastfeeding, you definitely shouldn't feel guilty about not being able to do it.
Sticking with the science for a moment, I did have this question initially earmarked for Liam, but I'm going to throw it to you, Gideon, without notice. The most compelling research comes from this probate study in Belarus. If you were getting operated on, but it was a country that was operating on you, not a surgeon, and you had to write your list of favorite candidates, where would Belarus rank and why?
So Belarus is a country that I trust very little for many reasons, one of which is that they lied about their COVID numbers throughout the entire pandemic. You know, if you look at the number of deaths reported by Belarus each day, they somehow managed to have 10.
Bernie Sanders mathematics right there.
Yeah, it was remarkable. There were lots of countries that lied about their COVID statistics in some manner, but none of them did it as badly as Belarus. Generally speaking, I don't trust them very much, the country very much. But the study itself has all the earmarks of authenticity that I look for in published research. I couldn't identify any serious issues in terms of potential fabrication or you know, numeric worries. As I said, it has limitations. Despite the education program, not every person chose to breastfeed. Despite the fact that it drastically increased rates of breastfeeding, there were still about half of the women in the trial in the breastfeeding arm didn't breastfeed. So the magnitude of any effect would be smaller than you might see in a trial where you managed to get that rate up to 100%. But generally speaking, I would say it is quite a robust and very large study. And when people criticize it for the limitations, all I can think of is that it is a travesty that this is the only piece of research we have on this very important question. I mean, why is it that the last large randomized trial of this nature was run in the early noughties? Why haven't we done another trial? Because you can't randomize children to be breastfed or not breastfed, fine. But you could definitely run another trial of this nature, of breastfeeding promotion, particularly in a place like the UK, where breastfeeding rates are much lower than they are in Australia. And yet no one has done that, as far as I can tell.
It's terrible. It's a really terrible statement.
It's bizarre.
Can I ask, I'm interested in your sense as a scientist on how much how scientific an approach you want to take to Gideon Jr., which I'm sure is what you'll be calling your child.
Absolutely.
Are you so some, you know, I've spoken to a few scientists about this, and some are like, oh yeah, I want to read all the research and apply everything, and then that's how I'll get the best outcome. And others are like, I spent my whole career in science, but science doesn't apply to babies. Like, where are you at on this?
Yeah, well, see, the thing is, right, that I am definitely a scientist, but the other more important facet of my personality is that I'm an obsessive pedant. And this has already irritated my wife, which is fantastic. I mean, I'm trying not to irritate her because she's pregnant, and that seems very rude of me. But absolutely, I cannot help myself. Every time someone offers us a piece of advice, I'm like, what does Cochrane say? The Cochrane Collaboration, which is the premier source for high standard medical evidence in the world. I'm like, I wonder if there's a systematic review on this question. And it's not even necessarily like a conscious choice. I just go on my phone and look it up. We had a great story. We had the NIP, non-invasive prenatal test, mostly to figure out the gender, which is why I think most people do it, but it also screens for Down syndrome and other chromosomal abnormalities. And so we were sitting there in the doctor's office, and I was like, I wonder what the sensitivity and specificity of this test is. And so I looked it up, and it was great. And then we had a conversation with the obstetrician about sensitivity and specificity and positive predictive value.
You would have had just such a much, and I do need to just say for the record, I made a Bernie Sanders reference earlier. I actually meant Bernie Madoff with the 10, 10, 10, 10, 10 and his stable returns from his Ponzi scheme fund. I don't hate Bernie Sanders.
I didn't quite get that. I was like, Bernie Sanders?
Bernie Sanders
anyway,
just like,
good
nah,
to but, clarify.
Yeah, no, it's just like I that joke doesn't anyway. Work. Yeah. I wonder if you would have just had a bit more of a presence in the room with these sort of appointments, because I just felt like Mr. Cellophane from Chicago, just like medical professionals looking right through me, because it, like, I kind of just sort of felt this appointment would be easier if I wasn't there, and it kind of would be for them because I'm not really providing a lot of value. I'm just a body in the room supporting my partner, whatever the fuck that means.
I mean, yeah, I think it helped that both of us understood most of the stuff. So there wasn't a huge amount of explaining. I think most of the appointments we've been to, they finish early and they're like, so do you need us to explain anything more? And we're like, no, thank you. We got all of that the first time. But I do understand that, because obviously prenatal appointments are entirely about her. We are mostly, you know, useless limbs sitting there. But it's also very helpful because it gives you a lot of understanding of the process and makes you feel involved, which is great. And I'm sure it's great support for your partners. I know my wife appreciates that I'm there. But yeah, it definitely gives me a different perspective when I'm constantly looking everything up.
We had the eternal problems of being science journalists. My partner's also a science journalist. Of knowing just enough to get you in trouble, but not knowing enough to get yourself out of it. So we had an induction, and our doctor wanted to induce our baby early. And so we read a number of studies about this and, well, you know, became very worried because the decision seemed to increase her risk of various negative health outcomes. And so we'd bring these studies in, and we're like, but this says this, and what are we doing? And our doctor would just look at us, and she's like, no, I'm the expert, and this is what we're doing. And at the time, I didn't like it. Looking back on it, really, it probably would have been better if we had have known less. We should have just, you know, as you said before, Alex, gone with the flow and let them be the very great experts that they are.
Breast milk, unless you can't, and then go with formula and you'll be fine. It's a great note to end on. Gideon, Liam, thank you so much for joining the Over My Dead Body podcast. I've had an absolute blast. I hope you did too.
It was
great
having
us, Alex.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So that was my conversation with epidemiologist Gideon Meyerowitz-Katz and science journalist Liam Mannix about the science of breast milk versus formula. Check out our episode description for links to Gideon's articles on the science of breastfeeding and formula, You'll also find a link to Liam's article on the experience of fathers advocating for their partners during birth. You should also check out Liam's new book, Back Up, about the science of back pain. Mind-blowing book. Thanks also to Matt and Ali for sharing their story with us. While it's a pretty intense case study, most breastfeeding stories don't go that badly. It is illustrative of the level of pressure on young mothers to breastfeed that all new parents bear witness to. We'll be back soon with some more episodes. In the meantime, my name's Alex Liddington-Cox. Have a good one. Yeah.